Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is MPB News.
Hi, this is Karen Brown. Thanks for checking out the Mississippi Edition podcast. If you like what you hear, click subscribe, hit like, or leave us a comment if your app has that feature. Then find other MPB podcasts by searching MPB Think Radio on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks. Good morning. It's 8:30 on Tuesday, March 16th. I'm Karen Brown, and this is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, with the goal of getting back to normal, the governor expands vaccine eligibility to all Mississippians. We examine the impact increased access could have in the state. Then, with stimulus payments from the American Rescue Plan on the way, we explore how the infusion of cash could help families in the Magnolia State. Plus, the Institute for the Humanities at MSU analyzes contesting narratives of American history in the political sphere. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. All Mississippians age 16 and older now qualify for a coronavirus vaccination, making the Magnolia State the second in the nation to expand access to such a degree. Governor Tate Reeves announced the expansion yesterday on Twitter with the stated goal of getting back to normal. Dr. Jennifer Bryan chairs the board of the Mississippi State Medical Association. She tells our Kobe Vance demand thus far has been strong and expects that to continue through the expanded eligibility.
So it's a positive thing when we see people stepping up and saying that this is my shot and I want to get my shot. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we have had a little bit of ability. You know, I know Dr. Dobbs has been working directly with the governor's office on some of these things. And so I think that they're going to be ready for it. And then how the public steps up will be interesting to watch. I do hope that we have a flurry of demand. And of course, we know that allocations are dependent on how we use our vaccines many times. And so the more we use it, then the healthier our vaccine supply is.
What do you think this is going to mean for Mississippians that, you know, want to return to at least a more normal life, especially as some people have not been able to visit a loved one in, say, a nursing home for a year now?
So we saw the CDC came up with the release guidelines about if but those people have been vaccinated, that it's okay to gather indoors without a mask. And I think that is a huge sigh of relief for a lot of people, just to have these glimmers of hope. While we're not returning to the huge mass gatherings and so on, certainly as more and more people are vaccinated, we're beginning to enjoy some of the things of old and past our normal experiences. So I think as more people become vaccinated, we'll see life slowly return to normal. We heard Dr. Dobbs on Friday say that we're not just throwing open the doors and the windows, that we're kind of peeking through the blinds, but that sunlight sure feels good as we peek through the blinds.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier that you hope to see more vaccines go to local clinics and hospitals. I'm curious, right. What effects do you think this change is going to have on those locations?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out is the Health Department Centers of Excellence program. That's been really a neat thing, and it's on their website, and there's a lot of health systems that are there, and there'll be more clinics probably coming online soon. But the doctor-patient relationship is really sacred, and a lot of times patients have a trust level with their own physician. And so there are many people that are just can't wait to get through a drive-through site and get a vaccine from whoever can give it to them. But then as physicians, we have long-term relationships with our patients, and these conversations that we have are profound at times in kind of gaining the trust of the public. And the health department has worked with a lot of private clinics. I think there's over a couple hundred, they mentioned, that are clinics now statewide that are administering vaccine. So they kind of went big from the beginning, was my perception. So they drive-through sites, hospital systems, as supply came in, and they built out a vaccine infrastructure. But that will be able to be nuanced more and more as we move forward and getting smaller batch shipments and so on to smaller clinics. So I hopeful in the coming months we see more of that in the medical home.
how should Mississippians begin to see how see the progress that could come forward from this when it comes to returning to that more normal life? What's a realistic timeline people should be setting for themselves?
You know, everybody wants to tell the future, and it's difficult. But I do expect that with precautions, the summer will feel more like normal. But that's, you know, everything is just dependent so much on our own activities. I mean, I don't know how many times we talk early on about the silver bullet that we all thought was our own behavior. So to the extent that we do the smaller things of masking up when we're sick and getting the vaccines and staying outside more than inside, as we go around other people who are not in our household, then the summer will feel more like normal. But that does not mean you will never see masks or you will not see hand sanitizing stations or that we wouldn't encourage you to be outside as opposed to inside. All of those infection control measures are going to be in the background to help reduce the spread for those who don't have immunity for various reasons. Remember, kids catch and spread coronavirus, and we don't know yet when we're going to get that vaccine for under 16, so they can still spread virus, and no vaccine is 100%. But we're not talking about no risk. We're talking about reasonable and acceptable risk, and that's different for some. That's different for different people about what level of risk they're willing to accept. But the summer will look better, and then in the fall, you know, we're hoping to move forward. And then I think we'll all be watching what's happening around the globe and with variants and vaccination process because we're all connected.
Dr. Jennifer Bryan chairs the board of the Mississippi State Medical Association. Dr. Bryan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
To meet some of the newly eligible demographic where they are, vaccination clinics are also being created and expanded to some of the state's colleges and universities. Sid Salter with Mississippi State University says this could allow more students and faculty to return to classrooms.
This will be, you know, in my estimation, a real game changer, not just for Mississippi State, but for higher education in Mississippi and across the country, because the more people that can become vaccinated and achieve a measure of safety through that, the slower the spread will be and the more real it looks to return to a semblance of normalcy. We feel good about the fact that we're going to be able to go to in-person commencement, although there will be some attendance limits. We've been able so far to return to limited attendance NCAA baseball, softball on campus, and all of that is a plus. But, you know, job one and the most important thing that we do here is try to get back to in-person classes and laboratories and to give our students more of the college experience that they want and that we want them to have. And so getting these vaccinations are a first step toward giving these students back the experience that they wanted when they made the decision to come here. And so we're excited about that.
And now you mentioned that this could be a game changer. I'm curious, are there any ways that you anticipate this could help change university life back to a more normal state in the fall?
Oh, no question. If we are able to get the supplies of vaccine and we get the compliance that we anticipate from faculty, staff, students, everyone in the university family, we certainly will be in a position in the fall to look at a normal schedule and normal operating guidelines. We're planning to do that at this point. And, of course, the vaccinations just cement that plan to be able to return to normal. We're obviously going to monitor the COVID situation moving forward and on a weekly, daily basis. But at this point, we think it's the smartest, safest thing we can do to help all the people that comprise the university family get vaccinated and get vaccinated here if possible. So, yeah, we're excited about it.
Sid Salter is Chief Communications Officer at Mississippi State University. Sid, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Between 60 and 70,000 vaccines are administered in Mississippi each week. A map with all of Mississippi's vaccine providers can be found on the Department of Health's website. Coming up, with stimulus payments from the American Rescue Plan on the way, we explore how the infusion of cash could help families in the Magnolia State. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, I'm Ryder Taff, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advisory and co-host of Money Talks. Each week, we take your personal finance questions and tell you about a money topic we hope you find helpful. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. Nearly 1.4 million Mississippi households are expected to receive stimulus payments as part of the American Rescue Plan. Singles who earn up to $75,000 will get $1,400. Couples making under $150,000 per year will receive $2,800. And parents who meet the income guidelines will receive $1,400 for each child. The money, says Olita Fitzgerald of the Children's Defense Fund, will provide families much-needed relief. She shares more with our Desiree Frazier.
So many Mississippi families have been struggling through this pandemic, and with people working part-time, people in and out of work. So this will be a great benefit for almost all Mississippians. Should not only help the families themselves, but be a major shot in the arm for Mississippi's economy. And for workers who have just been left out, who are in service industries and providing services like that. So this is a major, major deal for Mississippi. The median income for Mississippians is around $60,000. So this is going to cover, more than half of the adults and families in Mississippi.
Well, some might say, you know, $1,400 is not a windfall. Really, how much can that do if your rent is, say, $700-$800 a month?
Yeah, absolutely correct. We're hopeful that, there will be a continued moratorium on rent payments, but we know that that is a bill that is going to come due at some point in time. So there is that. But $1,400 and the additional payments per dependent child is a good infusion of money into a household. But it does not get at the root of the problem that we have. Now, hopefully, by this happening at this time, we are digging out from under COVID-19 so that people's lives might be able to hang on a little while longer until they can get back to some normalcy.
Overall, do you think that Mississippians are going to come out better after this is all said and done?
Well, Desiree, it's according to what happens down at the legislature. You can get this federal infusion, but it's only going to last us a couple of years. In addition to these resources, Mississippi is going to receive a substantial amount of money to help families with childcare costs. But families are going to have to know how to apply for those. That infusion is about $500 million just for the state of Mississippi. It's got to be obligated, spent out in 2 years. I mean, obligated in 2 years, spent in three. So again, that will provide substantial support for struggling families who need help paying their child care or who have not in the past been eligible to receive child care subsidies. So that's a special COVID package. Now, and schools will receive an additional infusion of dollars on the things they need included in the school money, though, something that we really need to pay attention too in this state is that there are there's about $100 billion set aside nationally for school facilities. And so many of our schools are struggling with facility costs because of the way the Mississippi has underfunded K-12 education in the past, and because a lot of school facility dollars come from the local tax base. There's a lot in this package. It will help us over the next couple of years, but it is not, we have to get back to the economy we had, though it wasn't good. We have to get back there, but we will still have the same problems with poverty that we have in Mississippi after this is over. So there's a lot of effort on the part of the advocates community and advocates for families to try to make that child tax credit increase permanent. That will help us tremendously. But all of this money will be in and out of the state in a matter of 2 to 3 years. Now, if the Mississippi legislature proceeds in eliminating the state tax, the state income tax, with the kind of nebulous programming and sourcing of funding through sales tax increases that they're talking about, that will come home to roost after this COVID stimulus money is gone. So while we are receiving this money, it will make things better for a little while. But the bigger picture around whether or not Mississippians are going to be better off is what happens in this legislature.
Olita Fitzgerald with the Children's Defense Fund, we appreciate you speaking with us about this stimulus package. Thank you.
Thank you, Desiree.
Coming up, the Institute for the Humanities at MSU analyzes contesting narratives of American history in the political sphere. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
On Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, you get information about foods you should eat to stay in good health and tips on how to stay active. I'm Dr. Josie Bidwell, host of Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, and Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Listen to the show every Monday at 11 or subscribe to the podcast by searching for Southern Remedy with your preferred podcasting app.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and depends on the support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate today at mpbonline.org. And thanks.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. The subject of American history, what it means, how it's framed, is at the center of a reignited clash. Since the debut of the 1619 Project, politicians, citizens, educators, and historians have newly engaged in a time-worn debate over the meaning and mission of America's historical narrative. Today, in a virtual event hosted by the Mississippi State University Institute for the Humanities, two professors and a high school history teacher will explore these tensions and discuss how the subject is taught and why it matters. Julia Osman is the director of the Institute. She tells our Michael Guidry she can't help but notice how contested American history is in today's political climate.
For a long time, there's been a lot of tension over what history is, what American history means, and how American history should be taught, especially at the K-12 level. And then just recently, there were these two prime examples of this tension. The 1619 Project, which tries to reorient American history around the experiences of enslaved peoples. And then, of course, the 1776 Report, trying to argue that American history is primarily a patriotic endeavor. And so this kind of battle over American history has always interested me. But here, right now, it really seems to be coming to a head.
The focus of this event is the meaning and mission of American history. So what is that? What does that mean? What do you plan on exploring?
Well, I plan on exploring, the issues about why are we teaching American history in the first place? And what American history is supposedly supposed to do. And I think that's where a lot of the tension is that we're seeing right now. Because obviously, you know, according to the 1776 report, American history is supposed to make us very patriotic. Like the meaning of American history is a very patriotic one, and its mission is to make all citizens just really glad to be an American and to support America. And most historians would absolutely outright disagree with that and say, no, that's not what history is. Myths are important maybe for generating patriotism or symbols or rituals or memories, but that's not what history does. History, you just want to understand what happened in the past, and you have to take, you know, all perspectives into account. You know, history is primarily about storytelling. How are you going to construct a narrative, a story that will explain how something happened? You know, what happened first, what happened second, what caused something? So rather than decide what the story is that you want to tell first and then try to find facts that fit it, you really need to look at the evidence in the past and then use that as your guide to try to figure out what happened.
You brought up the fact that, you know, the study of history is finding narratives or perspectives from which to evaluate an event or a series of events. The 1619 Project, when it came out and received the attention it did, was because it provided a perspective and a narrative of American history from a point of view that had often been, now I wouldn't say ignored, but definitely not part of the mainstream. So when you see something like the 1619 Project come out and see how it's received, and that it is a Black Americans narrative of the founding of the nation, what does that do to the long-held default narrative that is often shaped by the white experience in America?
Well, it challenges it. The really interesting thing about the 1619 Project is it kind of makes us ask, you know, why haven't we centered American history around the experience of enslaved peoples yet? Why haven't we considered this yet? Why don't we start American history at this starting point? And the thing is that the study of history is very much about debate. It's very much a long, ongoing conversation. And so I think the 1619 Project was valuable in, you know, making historians and, you know, members, non-historians alike, consider, you know, how are we telling a story and why are we telling it a certain way? Now, the 1619 Project, when it was first conceived and it was first published, wasn't perfect. And historians have continued to, like, talk about how the 1619 Project itself presents history. But that's part of what history is. It is supposed to be an ongoing conversation. And the reason why we keep publishing so many books on the Civil War or so many books on the American Revolution is that historians are always questioning what we think we know and reexamining what we know. That is just part of the process of trying to understand the past. And so it's been a really interesting challenge to try to think about, what would happen if we told it differently? What if we did put African-American experiences at the center of the story instead of kind of marginalizing those experiences or casting them as victims or things like that? And I think that's a good question for us to ask, and it's a good question to talk about and debate in the classroom.
What needs to change about the way we view history, the way we present history, and the way we guide the discipline of history in our schools?
What I saw when I was teaching history in the public school system was that it became very much service to the test. So, you know, rather than have a chance to really stop and explore and debate and develop skill sets in the history classroom around reading and writing and interpreting, history became very much about memorizing facts and being able to demonstrate that factual knowledge. And depending on what state you live in, you know, that test could exclude a lot of history that would be helpful to know, or that test could, again, try to teach students a very specific narrative of history that privileges some stories over others or leaves certain facts out. And then so once students are done with a history classroom, they might think that they really have a good understanding of history, but they don't. Just because, you know, teachers are not given the freedom to explore things that their students are interested in, or given the freedom to really, you know, let the students ask questions and explore different angles.
The event is from 1619 to 1776, How Do We Frame American History? It is a virtual event sponsored and presented by the Mississippi State University Institute for the Humanities. It's virtual. How do people access this, Julia?
People can go onto the Institute for Humanities Facebook page. If you go into Facebook and you type in, you know, Mississippi State Institute for the Humanities, it should take you right to our page. And then there will be a video on that page starting at 3:30.
Julia Osman is the director of the Institute for the Humanities at Mississippi State University, also an assistant professor of history. Julia, thank you so much, and good luck with your event.
Thank you.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Edition podcast from MPB News and MPB Think Radio. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, and if your app lets you, leave a comment or review. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can always get in touch with MPB News on Facebook and Twitter, and fresh episodes of the podcast are posted every weekday morning. I'm Karen Brown. Thanks for listening. This is Mississippi Edition from MPB Think Radio.